Tonight we have with us Dr. Bert Matheson. He is an ND, RD, LD. He's a naturopathic doctor, registered dietitian, certified diabetes educator. He holds a certification also in naturopathic acupuncture. Dr. Matheson is a general family practitioner who sees patients with a wide range of conditions. Some common disorders that he treats include allergies, asthma, infections, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, arthritis, hemorrhoids, irritable bowel, heartburn, Crohn's, food allergies, back pain, autoimmune, high blood pressure, cholesterol, migraines, eczema, psoriasis, PMS, hormonal imbalances. Lyme disease will be really covering fully tonight, cancer, and cardiovascular disease. Dr. Matheson has special interest in diabetes, weight management, and sports nutrition. He was the former nutrition consultant for the Canadian National Men's Gymnastics Team. Bert is a member of the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors, that is NHAND. He is on their legislative committee, and he's also chairman for their third-party reimbursement committee. He is actively working to help his patients obtain insurance reimbursement for naturopathic medicine. Thank you for being with us tonight, Dr. Matheson.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Great. We're glad to have you. I would love to start with maybe having you define what is Lyme disease.
Sure. Well, Lyme is basically considered an infection with the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi, and a spirochete being a spiral-shaped type of bacterium, and was originally first discovered, as most people know, in Lyme, Connecticut, and probably mostly through the efforts of a really persistent Lyme sufferer who started looking around at her neighbors and realizing that a lot of people in her community were infected. And she eventually got the public health board on track with that, looking into it. And in the meantime, the spirochete was discovered as the infectious organism in Lyme. So that's basically what Lyme is.
Why is it that Lyme is so hard to treat, Dr. Matheson?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the big problems with the organism and what makes it really unique is that it's able to change shape. First off, the spirochete form is sort of problematic because it's able to almost burrow in like a corkscrew into cartilage, into actually through the central nervous system, into cells. So it's a stubborn little thing. And it basically has different forms. It has a cell wall deficient form, which is sometimes called the L form, and also a cystic form. So it kind of flip-flops back and forth between these shapes, and the cystic form is very hard to treat with antibiotics. It's pretty much impermeable. So for those reasons and for the reasons that it can hide within cells, within the central nervous system, within the bladder, all over the body. So those are some of the reasons why it's so hard to treat. And I think the treatment course itself is hard for people because as the organism dies off, you get Herxheimer reactions, which are kind of a flare-up of inflammation probably caused by the host immune system, and endotoxins that are produced by the die-off of the organism. So it's hard to treat, and the treatment process itself is rather tough to take for a lot of people. So it's a interesting problem. It's kind of been compared to syphilis, and it's been called the new great imitator. Syphilis was once known as the great imitator, and so Lyme imitates many, many different diseases.
I'm imagining that might make the diagnosing of it a little more difficult as well.
Oh, yes, it does. It really does. I think a lot of people are basically misdiagnosed with, mm-hmm. with a lot of other diseases. And, it seems to happen all the time. A lot of people come into my office that have diagnosed with chronic fatigue or multiple sclerosis, fibromyalgia, all kinds of things. And you know, Lyme, as I said, can mimic all these conditions, so it doesn't makes it tough to catch unless it's high on the doctor's radar, and that leads into a whole other discussion, I think.
Yeah, but that would. Now, that's really interesting what you're saying about the different forms. I've never heard that before. That's actually quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Is there a reason? I'm sure there's a good reason for the changing of forms. Or is this just for the organism to be tricky, or is it for it to have different functions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's in terms of a bacterium, you know, it's a very advanced bacterium, one of the most problematic that we've really run into. And I think it in terms of DNA content in the organism, it has a lot. So it's able to do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So those are probably some of the reasons why it is able to be so tricky and evade the immune system. You know, probably, too, I think there's been some environmental impact here in, you know, possibly with global warming, the habitat has become more favorable so for this organism. So it ties into a lot of holistic problems, I think, for, you know, for the whole Earth in some senses, which kind of leads to many different discussions. But
yeah, there's certainly less ticks in the winter, so you're saying that the cold weather, they don't survive too well, but in the warmer weather they do?
That's right. I believe, I'm not sure the exact temperature, but they can hang around at fairly low temperatures, I believe, into the low 30s, even upper 20s. So yeah, it's kind of it's been seen all over the world in different temperature zones and in the most unsuspected places, unfortunately.
It's not just Connecticut anymore, is it?
No, it's not. It's definitely not. It's all over the place.
You were saying that you have patients from other countries that you deal with Lyme disease?
Well, I don't personally, but I actually did a preceptorship through ILADS mm-hmm. with a very well-known doctor out in New York who's treated about 13,000 Lyme patients. And when I was in his office, he had people from all over the world. He had folks coming in from Ireland and Scotland and all over the place. And
wow.
The same problems over there in terms of treatment and doctors accepting that the patient may actually have chronic Lyme disease. There's the same problems going on internationally. So it's a strange situation with this disease.
Yeah, it's not like we're the only ones that have dogs and cats either, huh?
No, I don't think so.
They probably have them elsewhere. Now, you talk about the evolving concept of Lyme disease. What do you mean by that, Dr. Matson?
Well, yeah, it's interesting in that I think when it was first discovered, we really just believed it was an infection with the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi. I hate that name, actually, because I lived in Alaska and I used to see, you know, the northern lights, the Borrelia. And so I'm sad that it's been named after the northern lights, but it does have that spiral shape like the northern lights.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, actually, most doctors now that treat Lyme are realizing that Lyme is rarely just one infection, and there are all kinds of co-infections
mm-hmm.
that are transmitted by the ticks. So it's really more of a Lyme disease complex than just a pure singular infection with the spirochete. So that's sort of the evolving picture of the disease. And you know, some common co-infections that come with the Borrelia infection mm-hmm. are, you know, things like Babesia, Ehrlichia, Bartonella. Those are the most common ones, but there are others too. You know, and good old-fashioned Rocky Mountain spotted fever, things like that, you know, that we've heard about in the past from ticks as well, is still a possibility. So,
sounds really complicated.
It unfortunately can get complicated really quickly. Yeah.
Well, speaking of that, I'd love to hear more about diagnosing. But before we go into that, why is there so much controversy that I've heard with this condition?
Well, yeah, there sure is, you know. And I think, you know, as doctors kind of enter this field, they get engulfed in it really quickly, and a lot of them get scared away, which is unfortunate because we really need more people that really want to help people with chronic Lyme. But I mean, I think the I think the controversy starts with the difference between chronic and acute Lyme disease. There's really no controversy that acute Lyme disease exists, and anybody would recognize that, and it's actually fairly easy to treat with a course of antibiotics. It's often undertreated and not treated long enough, and then you have treatment failure, and then people do become chronic. But I think the controversy ensues when we start talking about chronic Lyme. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it gets tricky there. That's where the argument begins. And what we've seen is that the Infectious Disease Society has published guidelines that basically deny the existence of Lyme disease. And it's a very unfortunate situation because there actually are many, many studies showing the persistence of Borrelia in the bloodstream, even by DNA analysis, after extended treatment plans. So this basic denial of the existence of chronic Lyme disease has really led to actual persecution of doctors who treat the condition, and it's actually led to insurance companies refusing treatment because they go against the Infectious Disease Society guidelines. So that's kind of where the controversy starts, and it goes on from there. And then you have folks mm-hmm. that are quite convinced, like myself, from having seen people with chronic Lyme disease a lot, and you have people who are quite convinced it exists, and they're wanting to treat it, and you have folks literally crawling in the doors in incredible suffering that have been bounced from doctor to doctor, and it's really terrible, actually, to see these people. And so you want to do something about it, and but you do get engulfed in this controversy. So.
Mm-hmm.
Such is
it.
Life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're really good at diagnosing Lyme disease. Can you share some pearls with our listeners? Because it sounds like it's not easy to really pick up exactly what, you know, it's this and not something else.
Yes, yeah, it is. It's tricky. You know, I think the first thing probably to realize is that we have to admit Lyme is still what we'd call a clinical diagnosis, meaning mm-hmm. that if someone crawls in the door, you know, with symptoms of chronic Lyme, they probably have chronic Lyme, you know. And but the problem is that the tests are certainly not perfect. One of the major problems is that the CDC has recommended what's called a two-tiered testing approach, which includes what's called an ELISA test first. And if that's negative, they recommend you don't go further than that. If it's positive, they recommend a Western blot.
What was the first test?
It's called an ELISA. I think it's enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay is what
right.
that stands for.
ELISA. Mm-hmm.
So it's an immune response test.
Right.
What can happen is people don't have an immune response because it could be too early in the infection, or it could be that their immune system is suppressed. So there are a lot of problems there, and it misses a high percentage of people, I'd say upward to 40%. So if you're in the unlucky 40% that were missed by the ELISA and the doctor decides not to go any further, that's a bad situation. I basically skip the ELISAs. I don't think that they're useful, and most doctors who treat a lot of Lyme disease feel the same way, and they go right to the Western blot. And so here's the other caveat on the Western blot is that a while back there was a vaccine on the market for Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. And if you had the vaccine, you would test positive on a Western blot.
Mm.
Now, the CDC screens populations, you know, epidemiological screening, and they want to use the Western blot to report disease incidents. So some bands on the Western blot, which are basically weights of proteins, as I understand it, in the organism,
mm-hmm.
Were taken off of the conventional Western blots. So, you know, you have Western blots out there through the major labs that are basically incomplete. And
really?
Yeah, so it gets even trickier. So people will have a Western blot and still be negative. And there are labs that specialize, you know, in tick-borne disease that have put those bands back on there and also made some improvements in the Western blots. And I've frequently tested through those labs and gotten a positive when the patient had come in the door saying, I've been tested three times with a Western blot, and see, it's always been negative. Which stirs up even more controversy, because then people think that, well, those labs aren't any good. You know, you're getting more positives, and what's wrong? You know, what's wrong with those labs? But really, they're specialists in that area, and they've done a lot more work on the testing, and then I trust them a lot more.
So Western blot as in BLOT.
That's right.
How do we make sure we order the right Western blot?
I would probably go through a couple labs for that. You know, my first choice would be Igenix, which is out in California, is quite well known. And there's another one called MDL. And yes, I believe that's the name of it. I mostly use Igenix whenever I can get away with it. And, you know, the problem is it's often not covered by insurance, so you run into financial issues for these patients as well. But whenever I can, I use Igenix. That's my preferential.
Is it I-A-G-E-N-I-C-S?
I believe it's I-G-E-N-E-X, Igenix.
Oh, okay, with an X.
Yes, with an X at the end. That's that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. So, and that's in California.
Yeah. That is out in California, right.
Okay.
You know, one thing that helps with diagnosis, too, is using symptom questionnaires when the patient comes in, and it becomes quite clear after a while when you see the symptom picture enough, and those are quite helpful for streamlining a patient interview. Yeah.
Do you know where we can find one of those?
I could send one of those out if people want.
Thank you so much. If you don't mind, if you get it to me, I will share it with our audience. I'll put it up on the website with your call.
No problem.
I'm sure they'll find it very, very helpful. That's very nice of you.
Oh, sure.
All right. So I know that you also talk about a differential diagnosis of Lyme-related symptoms. Is that different from what we just talked about?
Yeah, it really is. I kind of gleaned this from Dr. Richard Horowitz, who's treated about 13,000 Lyme patients. I spent some time with him. You know, you've got all kinds of symptomology that goes on with Lyme disease, and you basically want to work it from a real functional medicine, naturopathic medicine perspective. And so a person comes in, you really want to look for co-infections if there are symptoms. And, again, I have a co-infection symptom questionnaire that I could send out as well to nail that down for people. And you want to look for other infections like mycoplasma and chlamydia, because people are getting suppressed immunity, and, you know, pre-existing infections are going to flare up and all kinds of stuff happens. You want to look for other tick-borne diseases, you know, sometimes viral infections. So for the really complicated people, you really have to look further because they have really, really bad symptom pictures. And sometimes you look for immune dysfunction. I've done some immune cell testing with complicated cases. You want to look at things like candida, leaky gut, chemical sensitivity. You know, mold toxicity is another complicating factor here. Food allergies, really working it, you know, from a functional medicine perspective, stool testing, treating neurotoxins, sleep disorders. If they're not sleeping, they're not going to heal. One biggie is endocrine problems. You get HPA axis disorders with this disease. You're probably messing with the hormone receptors and messing with the regulatory mechanisms in the hypothalamus. So there's a lot of hormonal treatment that goes on here, too. And you look at, of course, metal toxicity is another biggie. I usually get around to doing some form of chelation with most of the Lyme patients, because that's definitely a complicating factor.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with these folks.
I just remember a few people that I knew in the past, and they kept telling me that they were diagnosed with Lyme disease, and I kept telling them, well, I'm sure you have Lyme, but most of the symptoms that have not gone away after your treatment sound like heavy metals and sounds like mercury or one of the others. And then finally, years later, they said, oh, finally got tested for heavy metals, and I'm through the roof.
Right, exactly. That happens.
Yeah. And then one of them said, you know, now that I think back, I used to work in a lab, and we used to use mercury in the lab.
Oh,
I just
yeah.
forgot all about it.
Oh, yes, the stories come out.
But I used
out,
to touch it with my hands. I said, that's good.
Right, or I used to, like, play in the clouds, you know, of pesticides yeah. as they sprayed the fields. You get all these stories like, do you think that mattered? Well, you know, that could have mattered.
No, we used to roll down those hills, right after they sprayed them, like golf courses, et cetera.
Yeah, little things like that, yeah.
Uh-huh. And think about.
Yeah, yeah.
And breaking the thermometers, things like
that. Oh, yes, yep. Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. They brought in mercury into my first grade class. I remember playing with it on the tables. If you can believe that, that wasn't too long ago.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you've talked about allergies a lot and, you know, Eliza and all that. We hear about molecular mimicry. Is that a problem with Lyme disease?
Well, you know, I think that could become a problem, certainly, where you're activating the immune system, getting changes in protein structures in the body, you know, due to the inflammation and our own endogenous immune activation causing inflammation to protein structures. So you definitely do get crossover immune reactions. And the Infectious Disease Society has basically said that chronic Lyme disease is what's called post-Lyme syndrome, which they say is an autoimmune disease. And there's some truth to that. There's a lot of autoimmune crossover, but there's also research showing that the Lyme organism persists in the blood after treatment. So, you know, the Lyme symptoms after treatment are not just what's called post-Lyme syndrome. But yeah, you're right. There is molecular mimicry going on with the immune system. And that's really a problem, too. And I think also just the fact, you know, there's another type of mimicry going on where, as I said, Lyme mimics so many other diseases.
Yeah,
so there's a couple types of mimicry going on here.
Yeah, sounds like a big immune mash mess.
It is. It definitely is.
I would love to hear you talk about the that target bullseye rash. Are doctors relying on this too much, or what do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, we all learned that in medical school. That was one of the first things that popped up in the early research in Lyme disease, which was mostly done by rheumatologists. So they were focusing on, you know, maybe immunological reactions to the skin, to the joints, and the target rash became an important sign. But many, many people do not remember any rash. In fact, they don't remember any tick bite, which
yeah,
is,
exactly.
You know, logical. The things are pretty small.
Right.
And I've seen sort of strange-looking rashes that don't look anything like a target, and the person develops Lyme disease.
Yeah.
So I would not put much stock in whether someone had a target rash.
Mm-hmm.
If they do have a target rash, that's pretty much diagnostic, though. So you don't even have to have a positive Lyme test. If you have a target rash, get treated for Lyme.
Yeah.
But if you don't remember one, that doesn't mean much, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yep, we rely too much on that for sure.
Okay, that's interesting. So, can't wait to hear about your treatment, and I want to hear more about, you know, the length of time for antibiotics and all that. But do you start with maybe a basic treatment strategy?
Well, I do. If it's an acute case of Lyme disease, you know, mostly what people do.
Can you define that first? Define what you mean by acute.
Sure, sure. I mean, let's say somebody got bitten by a tick and they come in 2 or 3 days later, maybe a week later, and they have a flu-like illness. You know, they have aches and pains and fever, and they kind of feel like they have the flu. And they do remember a tick bite, and it's pretty clear. Maybe they even have a target rash. So a course of doxycycline is usually what I start with. Even though I'm an integrative practitioner, a full, you know, naturopathic doctor, full believer in natural medicine, I just feel like there's a place for everything, you know, and this is the place and time.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. How long would you do that for?
I personally do that for 6 weeks. There's some debate as to the length of time.
Right.
Conventionally, they'll do it for a couple weeks, which really there's a lot of treatment failures after a couple weeks of antibiotics. So if it was me or anybody I know, I'd go for about 6 weeks.
Is the dosage based on the patient's weight?
For doxycycline, I've not seen that. Now, for children, that wouldn't be typically the one that I would start with. I would probably start with amoxicillin. But, you know, here again, the treatment of Lyme disease is probably more of an art than a science at this point, and I'm by no means the final say on any of this. But certainly for most people, I'm starting with doxycycline for an acute case. And going very heavy on probiotic support, you know, during that time, and I may even start them on some natural remedies as well, which we can talk about. But I do find that, you know, for the acute cases, they usually clear if you treat long enough and treat quickly enough.
So that's kind of doxycycline a one a day.
Usually twice a day, and. What I've learned from ILADS, which is a group that treats a lot of Lyme disease, is usually going for pretty high with the doxy. We usually go 200 twice a day, which is more than you usually see. But I do feel like that's necessary for Lyme disease. And you have to keep a pretty close relationship with the patient and see how they're doing. Of course, there are side effects to these things, and doxy particularly, you get sun sensitivity in the summer, so it's not really user-friendly in the summer, but this time of year, it's okay.
You're more prone to burning?
Yes.
In the sun? Yeah.
Yes, you get really, really bad
sun sensitivity.
That's right. So, yeah, the basic, you know, just some basic thoughts on treatment. You know, once you get into the chronic Lyme disease, you want to probably be changing antibiotics, switching them around. What happens is people will get a Herxheimer reaction, usually probably once every 3 to 4 weeks, which sort of correlates with the time span of the life of the organism. So usually end up just, you know, for basic philosophy, usually end up rotating antibiotics and also rotating natural antibiotic herbs and other nutraceuticals and taking an overall functional medicine approach to address any obstacles to healing. So it's kind of the basic approach that I take.
Excellent. But, what natural antimicrobials do you like, Dr. Matheson?
Boy, there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them, but, you know, there are probably three big protocols that are out there that most of my patients have experimented with, and I'll kind of list some of them that are well-known and what they're composed of. There's the Zhang protocol. Dr. Zhang, who's in New York City, is a Chinese medical doctor, and he basically uses high a concentrated garlic extract.
Okay.
You know, for its well-known antibacterial, antiprotozoal, antifungal effects. You know, you could use something like allicillin here. That would be a really good choice.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah. He uses something that's hard to pronounce, but it's marketed as HH capsules. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Latin name. It's an unusual one. And that's basically another antimicrobial herb. So this is his protocol. And then he uses a modified TCM formula, Persica formula, that's been modified, and it's marketed as Circulation P. It's basically been used to treat blood stasis over the millennia. And so we're looking to enhance microcirculation there and delivery of immune cells and herbal compounds to the body. That's kind of his basic protocol.
Okay.
And then the other one of the big three protocols out there is called the Cowden protocol. And this one I have a little bit more experience with. A lot of my patients have tried this one. And we've had some pretty good results with it. It's essentially a rotating program of multiple herbs that are grown mostly in the Amazon region, and they're in liquid tincture form, and they're rotated as, and they're also used to deal with Herxheimer reactions. And I'll just list a few of them here for you. The protocol usually goes on for about 6 months, and you're, again, rotating many different substances. So they're using Pimpinella anisum, and that's an anti-inflammatory herb, and it's thought to help eliminate toxins from the central nervous system and reduce brain fog. And then an herb extract called Desmodium mollicum, and that's marketed as Berber. Also parsley, which I believe is in the protocol to support kidney function and act as a mild diuretic. And then an extract from Atoba species trees, which is marketed as Banderol. And that's another antimicrobial, antifungal, antiviral. Has some action against the spirochete. And then cat's claw is a big one. In this form it's called Cemento. And that's in a couple different protocols. That's been out there for a while. And cat's claw actually was, I guess, approved by the Peruvian government as a medication. So it's been well tested, has some immune modulation and anti-inflammatory properties, and seems to be active against Borrelia.
Does it give people cat scratch fever?
I don't think so.
I'm just kidding. I didn't know that was a real disorder. I always thought it was just a song.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it can be a real problem.
I guess it can be.
My sister has a Maine Coon cat. I want to get scratched by a Maine Coon cat. Those are pretty feisty little beasts.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, they're cute, but they're feisty.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so they went through a lot of the herbs and cat's claw.
Yep, there are a bunch more. I'll just list a few. They use asparagus extract, something called Cumanda, which is the Latin name is Campisandra angustifolia. There are other combinations of multiple herbs. And then also using serrapeptidase, a proteolytic enzyme from silkworms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And okay. That's thought to digest the fibrin layer that kind of can wall off colonies of microorganisms.
Yeah. Just so everybody knows, the cerazine that's in our natto cerazine is the same thing as the serrapeptidase. That's our...
Oh, nice. Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then in this Cowden protocol, there's also a heavy metal component, and they're utilizing zeolite, which are some minerals from lava that are that are charged ions, and that seems to be helpful. And then the last one of the big three protocols out there is called the Buhner protocol, and his core protocol is basically andrographis. And then also Japanese knotweed, which is Polygonum cupidatum, hard to say.
Yeah, Polygonum cupidatum. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Same so, plant that gives us resveratrol.
Yes, exactly. And then cat's claw is also in his protocol.
Okay.
And he has some others for the co-infections. Artemisia is commonly used for Babesia infection. And then ceanthus, which is red root, as a lymphagogue to stimulate lymph flow and reduce inflammation in the spleen and the liver. And then Eupatorium perfoliatum, which is bone set, as an immunostimulant and diaphoretic circulatory stimulant. So there are different protocols that Buhner uses to address the co-infections, which a lot of my patients have used. So those are some biggies. And there are a lot of other antimicrobials that haven't ended up in anybody's protocol, that I've found to be quite helpful, like colloidal silver is actually very helpful here.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a good one. And olive leaf extract, another good one.
Yeah, olive leaf is great.
That's a good one. Thistle root and smilax. Grapefruit seed extract.
Yeah.
That's a good one, too. And that actually is helpful for the cystic form of Lyme, which is really nice. Nice to have something.
Yeah, that is strong stuff.
Yeah, that is.
If you ever put the oil directly onto your tongue,
No kidding.
Fun.
I'm to try that.
The cystic form. That's great news. Okay. Have you ever used the oil of oregano?
I have not used that particularly for Lyme, but as you're sort of working the rest of the body there, you know, a lot of times people will get fungal infections during this whole process, especially with the antibiotics. So oil of oregano is quite good for that,
mm-hmm.
for candida and other fungal dysbiosis.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
So I also use intravenous vitamin C therapies as part of my treatment plans as a natural antimicrobial. So there's a lot out there, and you just kind of try to rotate it back and forth, see what works for the patient, you know, and flip-flop it back and forth so the bugs don't get resistant to it. That's kind of my approach there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a lot of the other things going on, like the metals and the fungus and all that, which obviously a lot of people are dealing with. Are there any other treatments that you find yourself having to do because of other problematic symptoms or things that are going on along with the Lyme?
Definitely. You know, I mean, some of the big things, of course, that happen to people, and one of the major reasons Lyme was first noticed was because of arthritic symptoms,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
So that's a biggie. So you're definitely dealing with the joint symptoms, and most folks are going to need some sort of cartilage support, you know,
mm-hmm.
be that something like the ArthroSoothe, you know, with glucosamine and other things in it,
mm-hmm.
Some proteolytic enzymes just for basic inflammation support. You're definitely going to have to work the joint angle for most people. And, you know, just lifestyle things, too, keeping them moving, you know, get them moving and get them doing gentle exercise to support the immune system and the joints.
Right.
You know, and then the other thing that most people run into is fatigue, you know, and we have some folks that, especially if you've had this disease for a few years, you know, they're really fatigued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so some of the good basics for fatigue, you know, CoQ10, alpha lipoic acid, B vitamins, carnitine, these are some of the real good things for fatigue.
Mm-hmm. You're supporting the mitochondria.
Exactly. You know, and of course, just looking at their diet, you know, do they have reactive hypoglycemia? You know, is that why they're fatigued? You know, things like
that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Eating sugar and carbs and crashing every hour.
Exactly.
And feeding the yeast and everything else at the same time.
That's right, exactly. And you know, a lot of people are sort of feeding those adrenal glands because you do get such a hypothalamus gets dysregulated and everything gets offset, so they're medicating themselves with sugar.
Do you find yourself needing to give adrenal support?
Yeah, definitely. I do a lot of that. I do a fair amount of neurotransmitter testing and kind of look specifically and do some targeted amino acid therapy for fatigue. And you're really having to support a lot of symptomology, you know, with mm-hmm. these folks just to get them through the day, you know, if they've had Lyme disease for a long time. And, you know, the other biggie is the neurologic symptoms. You know, most people come through the door, you know, with joint pain and some numbness and tingling, you know, all kinds of weird paresthesias, shooting pains, burning, all kinds of stuff. And they're really confused, you know, understandably so. And, you know, some people said they had MS or, you know, whatever else. You know. And
sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, it does sound like it. And, you know, so you've got to do some things like acetyl-L-carnitine and another nice treatment, of course, sublingual methylcobalamin.
Yeah.
That's quite nourishing to the neurological system.
Right.
And we even get people doing, you know, a compounded injection of methylcobalamin, a very high dose, you know, like 50.
I
have people doing 15 milligrams a day of injected methylcobalamin through a compounding pharmacy. And that can help.
I mean, you can get it right into them quickly. Why not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can always follow up with the capsules or whatever form.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in my practice, we do a fair amount of intravenous nutrient therapy, and so we get people doing Myers cocktails and all kinds mm-hmm. of stuff, and that seems to really help a lot of people with fatigue.
Yes.
We'll do some IV carnitine at times as well. That can help.
I don't remember what's in the Myers cocktail. Is that choline? What is in there?
It's basically magnesium, B vitamins, vitamin C. I put a little zinc in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic mix. And
that,
I usually put
great.
Selenium. Yeah.
Yep.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
I always do one. If I'm getting a cold, I immediately do one of those.
Yeah.
Helpful.
I need to give one to my daughter. She just peeked in and said, my throat hurts. I feel like I'm going to get sick. grab some immunotone quick.
Exactly.
I'll make her up a Myers cocktail.
There you go.
You know, patients, we talked about the antibiotics, and a lot of patients have such bad intestinal side effects. What do you do to help them prevent this?
Right. Well, you know, I'm pretty hardcore on that. You know, if I'm going to be using antibiotics for an extended time, I really want to be safe with that. And so I actually go with three different types of probiotic. I'll go with a good high-dose probiotic, you know, even if you have to do multiple capsules. So I'll get up to probably about 60 billion organisms a day. I have a few different ones that I use. And then I actually do one also that's an enteric-coated probiotic.
Yeah.
I'm kind of going for the mass effect, you know, getting a lot of organisms in there. And then I'm adding a little extra insurance on top by getting an enteric-coated one that I know is getting deep into the intestinal tract.
Yeah, because otherwise so much is getting killed off by stomach acid, which is why so many people are used to using such high doses, because they lose most of it, and as soon as they give it to the patient, the stomach acid kills a lot off. So I think the enteric-coated is really smart.
Great. Yeah, I think it's really helpful, you know. And then we definitely try to get them to separate that by at least 2 hours from any antibiotic or even a natural antimicrobial compound. And then I also use Saccharomyces boulardii to prevent yeast overgrowth.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hitting them pretty hard with three different, you know, types of probiotics. And then I talk to them about, you know, the thing that everybody's scared of is C. difficile with antibiotics. So I talk to the patient about that, and, you know, here's what you do if you get diarrhea. You up the probiotics. You give us a call. We do a stool test quickly. So we try to play it really safe there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
That's the way to go.
All right.
Yeah.
Have we covered everything as far as treatment? And you mentioned that when they're on, you mentioned earlier when you have them on the antibiotics, you're also given the probiotics, and I'm sure that does help prevent a lot of those symptoms.
Exactly.
That's great.
Exactly. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot we could talk about in terms of the antibiotic philosophy and so forth, but I'm not sure if the listeners are really wanting to hear all about that tonight, but there's certainly...
Well, we're almost ready for questions, so if they do want to know more, they certainly can, I know that they'll ask you when we get to Q&A, which we're almost ready for.
Okay.
If people want to find out more about you or call your office, how do they contact?
Sure. You know, we do have a website. It's just www.nhnatural.com.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can just give us a call. It's 603-623-6800, and that they can get a hold of us via any of those means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what might be helpful, I'm thinking, before we go to calls, would be just a list of just go through a symptom checklist on Lyme disease to sort of paint the picture for people.
Yeah,
I think that would be helpful.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
Okay.
Great.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah, so, I mean, if someone comes crawling in the door with something like this, I'm just going to give a big list. You can see why this is misdiagnosed so frequently. So things that could be Lyme-related are things like unexplained fevers, sweats, chills, or flushing, which means just reddening of the skin, unexplained weight change, loss or gain, that could be fatigue, poor stamina, unexplained hair loss, swollen glands, sore throat, even testicular pain has been noted, unexplained menstrual irregularities, unexplained milk production or breast pain, irritable bladder, sexual dysfunction or loss of libido, upset stomach or abdominal pain, change in bowel function. Now, of course, as you get more and more and more of these things checked off, your suspicion goes up. Obviously, these can be related to a lot of things, but if someone comes in the door with a lot of these things, your radar should be on for Lyme disease. Chest pain or rib soreness, an interesting one. That's probably due to cartilage problems from the organism. Shortness of breath, cough, heart palpitations, heart block, any history of heart murmur or valve prolapse, joint pain or swelling. Now, a real red flag is migrating joint pain. You know, one day my knee hurts, the next day my knee does not hurt, and my elbow hurts.
Uh-huh.
And you can basically trace the organism as it jumps around the body.
Mm-hmm.
Stiffness of joints, particularly neck, muscle pain, cramps, twitching of the face or other muscles, headache, neck creaking and cracking, neck stiffness, tingling, numbness, burning, stabbing sensations, shooting pains, skin hypersensitivity, facial paralysis like Bell's palsy, vision problems, double vision, blurry, increased floaters, light sensitivity, ear problems like buzzing, ringing, ear pain, sound sensitivity, motion sickness, vertigo, poor balance, lightheadedness, wooziness, unavoidable need to sit or lie down. That's actually a symptom of a co-infection as well, typically. Confusion, difficulty with concentration, forgetfulness, poor short-term memory. These are really important. Most of the people do come in with cognitive complaints. That's a biggie. So look for that, you know, confusion, depression, disorientation, difficulty with speech or writing, word or name block, mood swings, disturbed sleep, too much or too little, early awakening, fractionated sleep, and exaggerated symptoms or worse hangover from alcohol. That's kind of a basic rundown, but I find the cognitive things and the pain are key, and the paresthesias, numbness, tingling. People get these strange sensations, and that's classic. That's classic. I've had patients that just come in, and the only thing they say is, my feet hurt. You know, and that's the only thing they're concerned about, but you push them a little, and you get a few more symptoms on this list, but you know, if you only heard about their feet, you might just stop there, you know, and never get the diagnosis. So
yeah,
these checklists are good.
Yeah, especially because patients don't think to mention all of them.
Exactly.
You know, they might remember a few, but first of all, they've got memory problems, so they can't remember them all anyway, right?
That's right, and doctors can't remember them all either. So.
No, I was just wondering if you were doing this off your head. I was very impressed.
I wasn't that time, but I probably could by now.
I bet you could.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, that's a long list, and I would say that there's a lot of people out there that have many of these symptoms.
Right, right. And like I said, the more you get on the list, the higher your suspicion should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just before we open for questions, because I'm anxious to do that, what's going on with this long-term neurological damage? How bad is that exactly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone had chronically did not know they had Lyme and it's been in their body for 3 years.
Yeah, that is definitely problematic. The longer you've been infected without treatment, the harder it becomes to treat. So if you're suspicious at all, go to your doctor quickly. But probably what's going on there is the organism does let out what are called neurotoxins. And there's probably also an immune reaction going on from the host. So it's probably twofold in terms of what's treating the what's causing rather the neurological problems. But it's the neurotoxins a big part of that, and there are things like Welchol, which was an old cholesterol drug that's basically a binder. You know, it can actually bind neurotoxins. So that's a common treatment for neurotoxicity, you know, as caused by these neurotoxins. That's pretty much what's going on. And then, you know, with the joint problems, you do get metalloproteinases in the extracellular matrix that are activated by these bugs. And so we kind of break ourselves down and, you know, start forming autoimmune reactions to the cartilage. So that's another problem, you know, of long-term untreated disease. So you pretty much see the joint pain and the neurological problems being the real red flags, you know, to untreated chronic Lyme. So it's a lot going on.
Yes, sounds like it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Are you ready for questions?
Sure, why not?
Okay. And what was the name of the that cholesterol drug? How do you spell that?
I believe it's just WELLCOL. I may have misspelled that, but
okay. Or maybe
pretty close.
COL for cholesterol, the COL. Okay.
I believe
that
so.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty close, yeah.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Sam. We're ready for the audience to ask.
All right. Reminder to everyone, hit star 1 on your phone to submit questions, and we will take them in the order in which they're received. And we do have a couple of questions already in queue. We'll go to our first question.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I would like to hear a little bit more about your antibiotic philosophy.
Okay, certainly. And most of this I've kind of gleaned from Dr. Horowitz, and pretty much what the basic philosophy that I learned was that you should combine mechanisms of action, and so we'll often use a cell wall drug that's affecting the cell wall of the organism, like the penicillins and cephalosporins, those classes, and then combine that with a drug that also can get into the intracellular spaces where the bugs are actually sometimes hiding. So that would be things like macrolides and quinolones and tetracyclines. Those classes can penetrate intracellularly, as I understand it. And then also it's recommended to use a cystic, a drug that can affect the cystic forms. So those are sort of the classic things like Flagyl, Plaquenil. Now grapefruit seed extract also can affect the cystic forms, so that's something else you can throw in. So that's kind of the basic philosophy, you know. It doesn't always have to happen all at once. You know, but if you kind of hit a treatment wall, then it's probably time to think about combining a different mechanism of action with the med that you already have. Does that help a little?
I mean, some of these could you use allicillin, for instance, or something like that for one of those type of?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure how you would compare allicillin in terms of mechanism of action. I don't know, you may know more about that than I do. But the benefit, certainly, to combining natural antimicrobials is that some of them probably have better penetration into the central nervous system. So, you know, things like certainly garlic extracts and some of the other natural antimicrobials that I mentioned, I almost always combine those with the meds. Of course, just screen for interactions, but it's great to combine because you do get that penetration into the central nervous system where a lot of these bugs are hiding and causing neurological problems and endocrine dysregulation. So, yeah, using the different... What's that?
How long will you, I know with you were saying with acute, you'll do around 6 weeks. With someone chronic, how long generally do you need to treat?
Right. And, again, that's sort of where this really becomes a little bit more of an art than a science. But I would say, honestly, the least duration I've seen for chronic Lyme disease was probably about 5 months of rotating antibiotics. That's an average treatment duration. A lot of people, it goes a lot longer. It can be months to years, unfortunately, with this problem. So you really want to be rotating these things and trying different approaches when you hit a treatment wall and combining natural therapeutics with the meds. So, yeah, it can be months to years, depending on the person and how long they've had the disease. And then sometimes there is a necessity of IV antibiotics as well at times. Although I find that bicillin injections, a penicillin injection, is very helpful as well. It's almost as good. Many people have found it's almost as good as the IV antibiotics. Some people really get a good response from that. So that's kind of a basic approach that I take. Can get a lot more information from ILADS, and they're experts at the antibiotic protocols.
Different than the Igenix you mentioned earlier.
Oh, yes, Igenix is actually a laboratory, an excellent laboratory out in L.A., and ILADS is actually a group of doctors and other healthcare professionals that specialize in Lyme and tick-borne diseases. Yeah, so ILADS is actually a professional group. Excellent resource for learning more about this business.
Just I and then LADS?
That's right, ILADS. And they actually have preceptorships that you can do I did. I found it to be very helpful if you think you're going to be treating a lot of Lyme disease.
Thank you very much. Very informative call.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad it was helpful to you.
Okay, we do have more questions in queue. Let's go to the next one.
Yes, hi. I may have missed the first few minutes, and I'm not sure if you discussed this. Actually, this is very synchronistic. My sister was actually found a tick on her over the holiday, over Thanksgiving weekend, and she went back to Massachusetts and was evaluated, and she had a very small bullseye rash on her abdomen, and she was put on doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day for 2 weeks. She has no other. What would you say about that?
Oh, okay, so it was doxycycline once a day for 2 weeks?
100 milligrams a day for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And what category is that? If you have the bullseye rash but you have no other symptoms, are you actually infected at that point?
That's definitely a diagnosis of Lyme disease. If you have a bullseye rash, you don't even have to test at that point. So that's confirmed acute Lyme disease. The definition of chronic Lyme disease is usually technically having had the disease for about a year and having some neurological and joint involvement. But in terms of that treatment approach, yeah, in my opinion and the opinion of most people who treat a lot of Lyme disease, that would not be aggressive enough. You would want to at least do 200 milligrams twice a day of doxycycline. And I would want to do it for 6 weeks personally because the lifespan of the organism is more than 2 weeks. So you know, the antibiotics and natural antimicrobials are going to hit these things in different points in the lifespan where it's more vulnerable. So that's kind of why you have to extend the treatment, because you've got to hit it at a certain time in the lifespan of the bug.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my opinion on that.
What about not having any symptoms? Is that a good sign that she didn't have any other symptoms?
That's a good sign. That's a really good sign. I mean, they treated quickly. That's great. We do just kind of find that there are a lot of treatment failures and relapses when you don't treat aggressively enough right from the beginning. So it's an excellent opportunity to, you know, to not develop Lyme disease, basically. You know, we're happy when people get treated quickly in the acute stage. It's just that I would probably encourage her to extend the treatment course and to increase the dose in conjunction with the prescriber. So she might want to have a conversation with that doctor or with another doctor that treats a lot of Lyme disease. So that.
All right. Thank you, Jen.
No problem.
Okay.
Excellent talk.
I'm glad it helped.
All right. We do have additional questions. Let's go to the next one.
Hello?
Hi.
Yes, hi. I have been treating more Lyme disease. I'm in Southern California. And what I'm finding is, I have a question for you in terms of rotating some of the herbs and the antibiotics. I don't necessarily find that people feel that much better sometimes. Sometimes they feel worse.
Right.
And it's hard to figure out at which point you change a treatment program because you're not sure if you're getting, like, Herxheimer or whether you're actually, that patient's just having side effects from the medication.
Right, right.
When you rotate herbs, like if you're going to be rotating different herbs, do you actually see that the clinical symptoms improve enough that you can say that the herb is doing something? Then it stops being active and you have to change to something else.
Right. Well, you know, the Herxheimer's are a good sign, even though they're really no
right.
fun at all for anybody involved. Basically, if the person still has symptoms of Lyme disease and you know, their symptom picture is still clear and they're not getting Herx's anymore, then that's probably the time to change the approach.
Okay.
Because if they're not better yet, but they aren't getting a treatment response, meaning a Herxheimer response from the natural antimicrobial or the antibiotic, I would say it's not as effective anymore, and there's potential resistance, would be my opinion there.
Okay.
And time to rotate. But yeah, understandably, I feel your pain on that. You know, I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to sort all this stuff out, and I'm not sure anybody does it perfectly. And I think as doctors, it's easy to beat ourselves up at when we treat Lyme disease patients because it's very difficult to sort out, you know, what is what, you know, what are these symptoms related to. But that's my basic approach. You know, when a person stops getting Herx's, then it's probably time to change the natural protocol and potentially the antibiotic protocol as well.
Of course, I've had better results when I've treated someone with acute Lyme because they get better.
And yes.
It isn't a problem. I had a 12-year-old boy come in, which was what we thought was Lyme. He had a very, very, very itchy rash.
Mm-hmm.
And his Lyme test was negative, but I've never seen the rash be very itchy. Can it be itchy like that?
You know, that's funny. I've not really heard that either, personally, from people that have had the rash. I've not heard that it was particularly itchy. Now, everybody's different, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he had fevers, joint swelling, and this horrible, horrible rash. And so we did do a Lyme test, and it was negative through Idenix. So
okay. There
was still some questions. I ended up giving him doxycycline because he had a parasite that was sensitive to doxycycline. So
okay.
I treated him for that, and he has gotten better. But I just wondered, I've never seen the rash be very itchy, and I wondered if that's if you have that experience too.
Yeah, I'd have to say I've not seen that be a major symptom either, the itchiness, interestingly.
Oh.
But he did seem to improve with the doxycycline.
I also finally broke down and gave him some prednisone because he was itching so badly. And this kid was just miserable, so I just gave him, let me do a low dose of prednisone. I gave him very low dose of prednisone for a couple of days and then tapered it down. And the combination of that plus a lot of proteolytic enzymes and an anti-allergic diet and the doxycycline, which was, you know, he had a parasite. He's gotten better, and I'm going to do a follow-up test. But he did have a very high SIV rate and a high C-reactive protein. So we're going to follow up that by rechecking those. Numbers and a high white cell count. So he had something going on, but his Lyme Idenix test was negative, and all his co-infections were negative too.
Interesting. Yes, the high white cell count, I believe, is also a symptom. Let's see here. It's Ehrlichia. That's actually known to boost up the – or actually, no, I'm sorry, it's the other way around. It's a low white blood cell count. You said he had a high white blood cell count?
Yeah.
Oh, that is interesting. Okay. Might just be a result of the infection in general. I've seen the low white blood cell counts.
The low NK cell count.
Oh, right. The CD57 cells, something else we didn't really talk about. Did you happen to check that on him?
I have not yet.
Yeah.
I plan to do that when I redraw his blood again.
That's a good one, too, yeah. That's nice to track. Well, great.
All right, well, thank you very
much.
Okay.
Oh, no problem. Okay.
All right, we do have 4 questions in queue. Let's go to the next.
Okay.
Hi, thank you so much. A lot of great information. I was the unfortunate recipient of a tick being on me about a year ago. Yeah, and I got very sick a week later and went to a walk-in clinic and was told that there was a bad virus going around, and that's what I had. And yeah, it's really a bummer. And about I got diagnosed finally through Igenix about a little over a year later, because I had symptoms all year and kept taking the Quest test, and you know, nobody kind of believes me, you know, the whole story.
Yeah,
so you've
heard
it a million times.
So many times.
Yeah. So you know, I've been on doxycycline now for about 3 months, the 200 two times a day with Plaquenil.
Okay.
And I have a few questions. First of all, I'm not sure what the Hertz reaction is. Is that when you have a worse reaction?
Yes, actually, thanks for asking that so I can clarify. Yeah, it actually is a flare-up of almost all of the symptoms, or at least some of the major symptoms. And it's related probably to endotoxins from the organisms as they die off, and probably also caused by inflammation from our own immune system. So, yep, it's a flare-up of symptoms.
Yeah, that's what I heard, because I never really quite got that, so I didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. So from what you're saying, it's kind of a bad thing that I'm not really on perhaps the right treatment. I mean, I do feel better, but you know, I don't know where I should be. I'm not quite that happy with my doctor. So that's another question, if I could maybe call you separately and see if you know
someone
in my area.
Sure.
Because I am a natural, you know, I'm a chiropractor, and, you know, I'm just kind of self-treating, and it's kind of difficult to do that.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
And I have another question that you didn't touch upon at all, but
sure.
My child was one at the time that I got bit, and I was nursing him the entire time, and then I found out, you know, that I had the positive test, and through this whole year, I said I got tested, and I did bring him to get tested, and I did subsequently bring, well, I went on the doxycycline until I told the doctor I was nursing, and then I went off of that, went on amoxicillin, and then I had to stop, I finally stopped nursing him, and that's when I went on the doxy, you know, for right now. But I did have him tested. I did give him the Igenix test as well, because I'm completely paranoid that, you know, I passed it through breast milk. So what's your feeling on that?
Well, I believe that it can happen. It certainly can be transmitted through the placenta, you know, in utero. And in terms of breast milk, I believe that can happen, unfortunately. But it doesn't have to happen, you know. It may be, of course, that he has a nice, strong immune system, and if he's had any exposure, he's been able to deal with it. Does he have any symptoms at all?
I don't know.
I mean, he's
2.5, so
it's
you know, I've tried to do research. I've asked people, and, you know, I don't know, because I think you really have to have a lot of experience with kids. I mean, there's nothing, like, you know, extraordinary that I would be overly concerned with. Like, he does get a rash on his body, but it's not, I don't know if it's related. I don't know.
Sure. Well, you know, look for things like, you know, he says, I have a lot of owies, you know, my knee hurts or my tummy hurts a lot all the time. You know, those are kind of some of the ways that kids express it.
Right.
And those should be some things to look for. And, you know, even, you know, just behavioral stuff. I mean, sometimes one thing with Lyme disease is that a lot of, at least in adults, a lot of psychiatric diseases are actually occult Lyme disease. It's never been diagnosed. You know, I've seen people come in where anxiety is their major complaint, you know, and it's been Lyme disease. Or a seizure, you know, is their major complaint, and it's been Lyme disease. So, but, yeah, I wouldn't get overly concerned unless you see things like that. You know, if he's saying I have
right, like his Identix test. I mean, they said it had one band on it, but that they say it's negative. But I'm just not convinced.
Yeah, just keep an eye out.
I'm really paranoid because my husband, yeah. Like I've got a tick bite. I got sick. 2 weeks later, my son got sick, and 2 weeks later, my husband got sick, and my husband got diagnosed with Lyme disease. It's kind of weird.
Oh, gee.
So I live in Connecticut, and it's okay. Just rampant around here. My neighbor's got it. It's crazy. So I would love to, if I could, follow up with you if you do know someone in my area.
Sure. I could give you some ideas on that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, that would be great. And just one more question. The iLabs that you said, is that a website?
It's a professional organization. And so you could just go Google iLabs, and you'll come up with their website. And they're a group of docs that treats a lot of Lyme disease, and they're very literate in the whole subject. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Dr. Matheson, I bet you're not all that far from Connecticut, maybe a few 2 hours or so.
Yeah,
I don't know where you are in New Hampshire. I'm not sure how high up she is in Connecticut, but
yeah, I'm kind of pretty close to Boston. I'm in southern New Hampshire, so I'm right on the Mass New Hampshire border.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in New Hampshire yesterday. It only took me a few hours to get there.
Not as far as
come to visit you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Sounds like
thank you.
Got a bum rap there.
Yes.
Sorry about that. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. We do have two questions remaining. We can go to the next one.
I just have a question about muscle pain. You know, so many of these patients present with just that, you know, muscle pain is just debilitating, and you just cannot sleep and can't move, and, you know, so movement is restricted, not to mention all the other symptoms that they have. So do you have any, like, silver bullet for this lingering muscle pain? I mean, there really is no such thing as a silver bullet, but, you know, I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Sure. Yeah, I wish I did have some silver bullets on that. I mean, I would say if, in fact, it's sort of a fibromyalgia-like muscle pain, you know, sort of taking the same tact as you might with fibromyalgia in terms of, you know, getting the person to sleep. They'll never heal from muscle pain or fibromyalgia if they're not sleeping, you know, because that's when the muscles are recovering. So that's like A number one, you know, maybe perhaps doing a neurotransmitter profile, looking at what's out of balance, doing some targeted amino acid therapy, just getting them sleeping, even if you have to use a sleep med, you know. And also, you know, tuning up the mitochondria, you know, carnitine, CoQ10, things like that. If, you know, you could conceivably just say that it's a fibromyalgia pain, which could be treated like any other fibromyalgia pain. You know, certainly natural anti-inflammatories, proteolytic enzymes, things like that, magnesium malate, you know, to get into the mitochondria. Those are a few things. Acupuncture, that may be a real good one, getting someone to do some acupuncture. Those are a few things. I don't know if that helps, but...
Yeah, I've got him. I'm working on with this particular individual. Unfortunately, he's had Lyme for 20 years.
Oh,
and has, and he's kind of a rogue kind of a guy. And a chiropractor that doesn't like, you know, the norm. He's just an outside-the-box kind of guy. So he's done a lot of things that have probably hurt him more than helped him. And now he's at the end of his rope, and he came to see me. And you know, this is like the perfect storm. I mean, it's, you know, 20 years. It's just everywhere. So,
yeah, that's really tough.
It's really tough.
When they come in that long after the infection, boy, it's a job. It really is. It can burn you out. I mean, you feel compassion for these folks and you want to help them, but it's like
fighting a forest fire, and the fire just keeps popping up. You know, you get it out one place, and then you get over here, and you're working on it over here, and then you got these other little, you know, firestorms that pop up, and you have to go back again, and it's just like popping the little game at Chuck E. Cheese up. You know, little head pops up, you're just banging on them all the time. That's what it feels like.
I totally
so, okay,
know
thank
what
you.
You're saying. Sure.
I appreciate your help. Thanks.
Oh, no problem. Sure.
Okay, we have looks like one final question. We'll go.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, well, I feel a little shameful or guilty about asking this question, but I remember hearing a discussion about Lyme's a number of years ago, and if I remember correctly, the doctor who was talking about it, who was a Lyme's expert, was saying that many, many, many people have Lyme's disease and it's going undiagnosed. And so I'm just curious about not about the acute phase, that's pretty obvious, but the chronic phase is mimics so many other diseases. And if you don't have a good way of testing in the laboratory, how much of this do you think is psychological, and how can you differentiate between a psychological problem and a physical medical problem like Lyme?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there certainly are people out there that are hypochondriacs and are not really experiencing these symptoms. Most people that come into my door, I really believe what they're saying. I mean, you can see that they're in pain. You can see that they have paresthesias and you can certainly tell by talking to them that they have cognitive problems. I don't feel like I've encountered anybody so far that's actually making it up, so to speak. Certainly the mind is very powerful and can create symptomology, but I just haven't really had that problem much where I haven't thought the person was really truly experiencing the disease. You can also test them by different means. There are different ways of testing, so you can kind of go through a tiered approach of trying some different tests if others were negative. I don't know. Does that answer your question at all?
Well, not exactly. I don't mean that people aren't experiencing the symptoms. I mean, there's lots of people that have, like, all the symptoms that you listed that should make you suspicious. There's lots of people that have symptoms like that who don't have Lyme's or it's difficult to prove they've got Lyme's. And I'm just wondering what you do when it's difficult to prove, or do you find that it's not difficult to prove? Are you going where the laboratory is equivocal? Are you going mainly clinically by the list of symptoms that you gave?
Yeah, I really am. Yeah, I think most people that treat a lot of Lyme disease will openly admit that Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. That if it looks like a duck, it probably is. And I do go by the clinical signs oftentimes because laboratory work certainly is imperfect. So yeah, I've treated people that have been negative on lab tests and have all the symptoms, and I've seen people get better, oftentimes, more often than not. So yep, that's my approach, and I think the approach of most folks that treat a lot of this disease. They will treat clinically, which is kind of a lost art. I think maybe sometimes we rely too much on lab testing and we forget about, physical exams and how to look at the overall clinical picture.
Right.
But yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks very much.
No problem. Sure.
Dr. Matheson, two additional questions have popped up if you have time.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, let's go to the next then.
Yes, you want people to be having HRXs as a sign that what you're doing is having some impact on their treatment, especially with anxiety as a HRX or more severe pain. How do you help them through that time?
Right, yeah, that is troublesome. And I don't mean to portray that people have to be having terrible Herxheimer reactions and that you have to be really pushing it.
But some of them are terrible.
Yeah, they are, exactly. You don't necessarily want that on purpose, that's for sure. But some of the things that I've seen used for Herxheimer reactions, at least in the Cowden protocol, that seem to help is using this Berber extract and the parsley extract. That seems to help a lot of people through a Herxheimer reaction. And we have them doing 10 drops actually every 10 minutes or so during a Herxheimer reaction. That's one thing that I've seen can help quite a bit. So that's a good place to start. In terms of anxiety, you know, reaction, I usually get around to doing some cognitive support for most of these folks. So, you know, looking at a neurotransmitter balance profile and potentially using a GABA agonist. The one thing I use a lot of is called cabinase, which is basically a modified GABA that crosses the blood-brain barrier. That's really helpful for anxiety. It can get people past some of this. Theanine, I use a liposomal theanine preparation. That's really helpful as a GABA agonist. It's nice to be targeted and look and see what's high and low, so you can be a little more targeted, but certainly 5-HTP is another thing. Taurine, all of those substances are really helpful for anxiety. Does that help a little?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay. No problem. Sure.
Okay. And here's the last question.
Sure.
Oh, hi. Great talk. Very well stated. Dr. Selma Jones, I've worked with Lyme disease for many, many years. I just wanted to perhaps bring people's attention to what you're probably familiar with, Brian Fallon's work on the neuropsychiatric manifestations of Lyme. He has an extensive writings. I've spoken with him at length. He's at Columbia Presbyterian. I think he's no longer seeing private patients, but he's done a lot of studying with PET scans and Lyme disease patients. So he has extensive literature on the neuropsychiatric manifestations of Lyme, and they're amazing, as you know, with panic attacks and all. Now, personally, I've seen several people with Alzheimer's with a diagnosis of Lyme that has been missed, you know, many of them. Yeah, and I have to say this, that I do send them to reputable people for spinal taps because they could have Alzheimer's and Lyme disease. You know, they could be carrying the genetic predisposition to Lyme, so someone may not necessarily know, although I've seen some improvement. It could be that the Lyme disease is accentuating the other manifestations of the illness. So I think that's a mixed bag. I personally believe that anyone with a mental illness and has been in an area or one is suspect, I would always work them up for Lyme and send them to Igenix, because the labs, as you so well stated, are pretty I would never go make a diagnosis or not make a diagnosis on a negative test. So I thought that information about Brian Fallon, for somebody who asked about what do you do when somebody has these manifestations, I agree with you. It's just such a clinical, intuitive diagnosis. So I appreciate your emphasizing that, because people rely so heavily on the Lyme test.
They really do, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that's just so great that you mentioned that and emphasized that, because it's just such a tragedy.
It really is. You know, these poor folks get bounced from doctor to doctor, and they, as I'm sure you've experienced many times, they come crawling in your door, and it's so obvious. You know, I just hate to say it, it's so obvious that they have Lyme disease, and you just can't believe that no one, you know, has treated them for 3 years or however long it's been, you know.
I've seen some for 15 years.
Oh my God.
People who have been under psychiatric care for 15 years. I did some work together with Joseph Burscano. You know him?
Yes. I don't know him, but I certainly know of him.
Yeah, he's on the island, and I've sent a lot of the people with neurological Lyme to Pat Coyle, who I think does an excellent job.
Yeah,
She's very good at diagnosing that, and she's interested in MS as well. So thank you again, because that is the thing that perked up my antennas.
Oh, no problem. Well, thank you for listening.
Welcome.
Okay, bye-bye now.
How are we doing there, Sam?
Actually, one more question has come in. Do you want to take this last question?
Oh, certainly. Boy, we'll maybe have to do this again.
I know. We wouldn't want to leave one left behind either, right?
That's right. No man left behind.
Yes, thank you for this wonderful talk. I live in Connecticut, and I have a 4-year-old family member who was diagnosed with Lyme following headache and Bell's palsy. He was treated for about 6 weeks, I believe, with amoxicillin.
Okay.
Now, is the Bell's palsy a sign that he's had Lyme for many, many months,
or can that be an initial sign that he just, because he didn't have any bullseye rash that we know of. And, you know, kids often have fevers, and, you know, so it's hard to know how long he had been sick.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I don't exactly know the specific answer to that question, but my gut reaction is that you would have had to have had it at least early disseminated Lyme disease, which, you know, say 2-3 months before you're going to see a manifestation like that. I could be wrong, but that's sort of my gut feeling on it.
Okay, it did clear up in about, in 2 weeks, the Bell's palsy was gone.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Treatment. So it did respond nicely.
Interesting.
But occasionally now he's a little whiny. He's 4.5 and still needs a nap. And I'm wondering, is he fatigued or is he just an active kid who needs a nap?
It's
really hard to know.
It really is. I mean, does he have any other glaring symptoms that you're...
No.
Mm-mm. Okay.
I mean, sometimes, like I said, I sometimes think he's whiny, but I don't know if that's just because he's whiny. You know, he's not complaining of headache anymore.
Okay.
And he's running around fine. Previously, I think he was complaining about, I don't want to walk, please carry me. Thinking maybe that was a knee problem or a joint problem that went undiagnosed because, you know, kids were kind of whiny and wanting to be carried.
Right, exactly.
It's hard when you've got a child wondering how they're really feeling.
Boy, it really is. Kids are tricky with this disease. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, it sounds like he's recovered pretty nicely. If that's the only thing you're sort of noticing is that he needs a nap, that's probably not too unusual. I just keep your eyes open, you know, for anything else. If he starts asking to be carried again or if he has a lot of owies or, you know, something like that.
Okay. Thank
or
you.
Tummy aches all the time. Those are the big ones to look for.
Okay. No, that seemed to be okay. Thank you.
All right. Sure. Okay.
So much.
And no
problem.
No amalgam fillings for him when he gets older and starts going to the dentist.
There you go.
That's right.
Get rid of those things. Are we all set?
Thank you so much. I think we're all set. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for all the great questions, and I appreciate everybody that was on live tonight. This call will be on our website probably by Friday afternoon. So tell your friends that missed the call. They can go hear it in our library, www.designsfelts.com, in the clinical round section. And thank you, Dr. Matheson. It was fantastic information, and I think that you should join us again.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Great. So did we. Glad you had a good time. All right. Good night, everybody. And thank you so much for all of your time you spent with us tonight.